Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. As the aftershocks from Thursday night's airstrike on an Iranian military leader continue to ripple across the globe, we're going to examine what's at the core of President Trump's foreign policy and how American voters perceive what drives his decision making. When the left-leaning Center for American Progress asked voters in focus groups and a poll last year how they would identify Trump's foreign policy goals, 51% said they understood what America was trying to accomplish globally. 43% said they were confused about American goals and strategy in the world. Voters also identified some interesting priorities that the U.S. should be aiming for. I'd like to know what you'd have to say about this. As our guests join us this morning, do you have a clear sense of the doctrine or the specific goals that determine how President Trump makes foreign policy decisions? How much do you care as an American voter about the way the United States is seen by foreign friends and foes? So I'd like to know, in light of this action on Thursday and some of the things that the president has been talking about over the weekend, whether you have a clear idea of the specific goals that determine how President Trump makes these foreign policy decisions. And then, as an American voter, is it important to you in the way that the United States is seen by the rest of the world? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, already hearing from you there. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest this morning, Brian Katulis, is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's an expert on counterterrorism and national security. He was part of this polling and these focus groups that I talked about, and he joins us today from Washington. Brian, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Barbara Slavin is with us. She's director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And we find her this morning in Naples, Florida. Hi, Barbara. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Brian, first to what we're learning about the way President Trump and the team made the decision to kill this Iranian military leader who was in Iraq. Over the weekend, Secretary of State Pompeo has been saying that they did it to foil an imminent attack. Other foreign policy experts are saying this was about opportunity. He was in a place where the United States could get to him. Now that you've seen some of the competing narratives, what do you think?
I think we don't know enough, and President Trump took a very risky decision here and hasn't informed the American public, and for that matter, leaders in Congress, about the nature of this threat that they're claiming existed that was imminent. And that's troubling. That's troubling for our democracy. That's troubling for our position in the Middle East. Because if we're going to take such a risky move, and I think we need to still debate whether it was wise to take this, because I think it's more risk than any potential payoff, we need to have an informed discussion about it. And President Trump seems to be able to tell his buddies at Mar-a-Lago that something like this is coming, but doesn't inform our very system of government, our democratic government, about this. And it's troubling because we are on this escalatory path with Iran, and this may not be the end of it. So we need more transparency and accountability and
Brian,
a check on Trump.
I think you're referring to conversations that the president had at Mar-a-Lago with Senator Lindsey Graham. So let me ask you this, since you've mentioned Congress. Do you think if the administration had brought members of Congress from both parties in on this decision, it would have shown you more of an indication that there was a strategy, or it's just in the idea that maybe they would have heard some competing ideas and probably would have carried out the strike the way they did anyway?
I think Trump, given how he's acted on foreign policy, would have done what he wanted to do anyway. And that's a troubling thing for many Americans. As you mentioned in our research, which resulted in this report called America Adrift, where we listened actively to the American public, one of the leading concerns, even among Trump supporters, about President Trump's foreign policy is that he's a man without a plan, that he does things impulsively and erratically. And most Americans, this is not a partisan issue, want a steady hand in the Oval Office as the commander in chief. So I don't think for a minute that following sort of the letter of the law would have led to more judicious action on the part of Trump. He's demonstrated that he doesn't care about those checks and balances. What I'm talking about is actually a much more clinical and balanced debate that is about, okay, whether or not our leaders in Congress are involved in this, and moving forward, they should, I think, put some serious constraints on his ability to make decisions like this.
Yeah, Brian, we're reconnecting with Barbara, so let me ask you a few more questions here while we do that. Do you get the sense that the way the decision was made, that you can see a through line through some of the president's other foreign policy decision-making? I'm thinking about the decision to bomb some sites in Syria. I'm thinking about some of the force deployment decisions that the president has made. Can you say, I see a doctrine at work there, and I see a doctrine at work at the heart of this decision, and there's a connection, a commonality between the two?
It's hard to find a coherent approach here, but I'm reminded of a discussion I had with a senior Trump advisor early in his administration, and he said to me, what you people, what you internationalists don't get is that President Trump is about to do to foreign policy what he did to the Republican Party, to the media, to social values in the United States. He's going to disrupt it, and he's going to be very unpredictable.
Barbara, are you with us now?
Yeah, sorry,
okay.
My line.
No problem. Dropped. Glad you're back. I was asking Brian something that I'd love to hear you on as well. When you see President Trump execute other foreign policy decisions, the strikes in Syria, the forced deployment decisions, do you see any commonality in the decision-making on those incidences that might connect to the way the president made the decision on this military strike in Iran, in Iraq?
I do, in the sense that he's very erratic and unpredictable, that he seems to change his mind frequently, depending on what he's just seen on television or who he's last talked to. I keep thinking of how he decided abruptly to pull U.S. troops out of Syria after a conversation with the president of Syria, Erdogan. In this case,
With a conversation with the president of Turkey, yes.
Right, and then he suddenly announced on Twitter, I think, that he was withdrawing all U.S. troops from Syria. Yeah. In this case, I'm not sure who it was. I mean, there are reports that Secretary of State Pompeo and Vice President Pence were very much in favor of this option. Unfortunately, the administration has lost most of its real expertise on Iran. Many people have been reassigned, fired, or have quit. And clearly, there was very little thought to what impact that this would have on Iran, on public opinion there, on the internal politics of the country, as well as the internal politics of Iraq. So I think it was just stunningly poorly thought out, extremely risky, and I'm very, very worried about the consequences.
On the other hand, Barbara, if you look at some of the more consequential foreign policy decisions that have been made in fairly recent American history, let's say the invasion of Iraq, you can also see an administration that did not calculate the ongoing consequences of that decision. Is this, you know, given, and you're saying you're worried about what comes next, how unusual is this opaqueness about what's going to follow a decision like this?
Well, you know, in the case of Iraq, I didn't agree with that decision either. But there certainly was a much wider circle of consultation. There were fears, which turned out to be unfounded, that Iraq was indeed reconstituting its weapons of mass destruction program. And, you know, the United States, of course, was still in the throes of a post-9/11 panic over the possibility that a government that was violently opposed to the United States might be developing WMD. Mm-hmm. I think what's so tragic about Iran is that we had a deal with the Iranians, which prevented them from developing nuclear weapons. Now they're really pulling out completely from that agreement, or almost completely from that agreement. Plus, we have roused this intense animosity, not just from Iran, but from all the various anti-American forces in the Middle East, some of which, you know, identify with Iran and some of which have their own ideas. We're encouraging ISIS. We're encouraging radicalism of both the Sunni and Shia variety. And we have a president who does not consult experts very much, who really shoots from the hip. It's frankly even more terrifying. Remember also that Iran is a country of 80 million people. Its territory is three times the size of Iraq. And it is much more influential in the region precisely because of that Iraq invasion, which eliminated Saddam Hussein and opened Iraq to Iranian influence. So this is, frankly, more terrifying on many levels than even the Iraq invasion.
If you're just getting in on the show here, I want to let you know that Barbara Slavin is with us. She is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And Brian Katulis is with us. He's a senior fellow on the national security team at the Center for American Progress, and they've done some really interesting polling and surveying of American voters about their views of American foreign policy. As we talk about the ripple effect globally of this decision that President Trump made on Thursday on this strike in Iraq of a top Iranian military leader, we're talking about whether we see the essence of a Trump doctrine on foreign policy. Can we connect it with some of the other foreign policy decisions that the president has made? And as American voters, I'm really curious about how you see this. Do you have a clear sense of the specific goals, the tenets that determine how President Trump makes these foreign policy decisions, especially the consequential ones like we had on Thursday night? And then I want to know how much you care as an American voter about the way the United States is seen by foreign friends and foes. Here's the phone number through the Upper Midwest, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 in the Metro and on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where Johan says, I don't care how we're seen overseas, same as I don't care how others see me. More important, I want to vote for candidates who would do the right thing. Then our image overseas can vastly improve and we won't be the stupid country in the world. To the phones, to Luis in Minneapolis. Hey, Luis, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, no worries.
What are you thinking about?
So the question that I kind of had in general was, why the outrage? As somebody who definitely is a part of the global world, what people think about us and the soft power we exude is extremely important. But as a student of history, the reality of American gumboat foreign policy has always been a part of American foreign policy. From everything from Commander Perry's forced opening of the ports of Japan in 1848 to the propping up of several governments, the destabilization of the Hawaiian country that eventually would become a state, the supporting of the Shah of Iran to solidify relations in there. So at what point is this any different than what has traditionally been a part of that?
Yeah.
I don't see it as something different, because Trump is basically continuing on a legacy of American gumboat diplomacy.
Luis, so, I really appreciate the context. I think we have the essence of what you want to say here. And Brian, I'm curious to hear what you'd have to say to that.
I think what's qualitatively different about this here in 2020 and this specific instance is that we have a president of the United States who actually doesn't seem to have any broader world view about where America is going in the world. He, as Barbara mentioned, is erratic and makes these impulsive decisions. And as we started to talk about, in addition to this strike against Soleimani, the airstrikes that he had in Syria last year and the year before, not connected to any sort of clear sense of what America is actually trying to get done. In those previous instances, there was, I think, whether you agree or disagree with it, there was more of a sense of America's coming onto the world stage and it's trying to shape events. My take and my analysis is that President Trump on any given day will contradict himself and confuse a lot of people around the world. And these actions are quite dangerous in and of themselves, but then when disconnected from any sense of a strategy. You don't know if he's going to actually bomb Iran tomorrow or fly to Geneva and meet with President Rouhani of Iran. That's how erratic he actually is. And that's what's qualitatively different right now, is that I think many Americans are looking for a steadier hand up there.
Yeah, Brian, listen to what Joe on Twitter here says. Given what you've just said, Trump's foreign policy behavior is derived from Nixon's madman theory of foreign policy, which is to act unstable and easily violent to keep foreign actors paralyzed with cautious uncertainty. How does Trump's application of the madman theory differ from Nixon's? Brian, do you buy the pretext there? Is there some similarity?
Well, there's a lot of similarity between Donald Trump and Richard Nixon, including the threat of impeachment. But on the world view and the world stage, I think the real big difference is that Nixon actually had some sort of strategic vision, agree or disagree with it. And it may be this tactic of uncertainty and being erratic to be unpredictable in the world was something that Nixon shared in part. But he did have this broader strategy of trying to engage countries like China, the opening to China to try to counter the Soviet Union. There was a broader theory of the case. And frankly, even among Trump supporters and friends of mine who are conservative, I'm more liberal, we all scratch our heads in trying to figure out exactly what drives President Trump and his decision making on many issues. And I think it's what's particularly dangerous about this episode is that it looks like we're in a cycle of escalation that could lead to a war, which, is the thing that President Trump says he doesn't want to do in the Middle East. So that's what's confusing and confounding.
A call here for you, Barbara, from James in Roseville. Hi, James.
Hello, and how are you today?
Doing good. I'm glad you called. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Well, I think that your guests are misconstruing what President Trump actually is. He told us from day one that he would put America first, and he has done so at every opportunity, whether it was with jobs or whether it was with dealing with foreign powers. He has always put America first. This general that was eliminated was a serious threat. Mm-hmm. He has caused many American deaths, and we took the opportunity to eliminate him, no different than what we do with bin Laden.
So, James, it sounds like you see a common tenet of this move by President Trump on Thursday night with some of the other foreign policy decisions that he's made.
Yes, very much so. Like I said, it's putting America first. And as a veteran, I can honestly tell you that no president has looked out for veterans and our servicemen the way that President Trump has.
Okay, let me take what you've said to Barbara, and I appreciate the call. Barbara?
Yeah, look, you know, it doesn't put America first if the United States is isolated in the world because of actions that it takes. It doesn't put America first if our influence in the world is reduced, particularly in an area as important as the Middle East. It's not accurate to equate Soleimani with Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden was the mastermind of an attack on American soil that killed 3,000 Americans. Iran has never killed Americans on American soil. It has directly or indirectly attacked our military forces when they have been involved in various interventions, whether it be in Lebanon or Iraq. But that's very, very different from what Osama bin Laden did. My beef is with the policy, which I believe is going to hurt American interests. It will not mean America first. It will mean America alone and America last. And you know, Trump also is threatening the lives of American servicemen, more and more being sent to a region where he said he wanted to stop endless wars and not start new ones.
We're having a conversation this morning about whether we see a common sense of principle, the essence of specific goals in foreign policy with what President Trump did on Thursday night with this strike in Iraq on this Iranian military leader and some of the other foreign policy decisions that he made. We're taking note of some of the questions that are coming out in the wake of this move on Thursday, but also trying to make some connections, if there are any, between some of the other consequential decisions that the president has made on foreign policy, and asking for your thoughts on that. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. I want to play something. We had a conversation on Friday morning with Ken Pollack, an expert on foreign affairs and in the Middle East, about how he saw the decision on Thursday night and what he is most concerned about, including kind of a slip-sliding into war. Let's listen.
This looks like an attack that was simply a target of opportunity. The U.S. got an intel tip that put Soleimani in a place and a time where the United States could take him out, could assassinate him, and Trump decided to do it. And I'm worried that the U.S. didn't really have much of a process, that we didn't really consider how Iran would respond, how we would respond to any Iranian response, what the escalatory cycle could look like, how we would prevent this from escalating.
Ken Pollack there with us on Friday morning as the news was developing. To the phones here to Aaron in Minneapolis. Hi, Aaron. Hey, hi, Aaron. Hey, what'd you want to say?
Hi. I had a question for your guest about you're talking about the sort of broader strategies of what might be the broader strategies of what I consider to be sort of a transparent cryptocracy. The guy that was just on saying, well, he's doing what he says. Well, he is, but he's also being very opaque about what his goals are and how he wants to achieve it in certain regards as well. And I'm curious if your guests think that given the makeup of the higher cabinet officials, whether or not the real goal here is to establish a theocracy in the United States.
Brian, do you want to tackle that?
Well, 2 points. First, President Trump's cabinet right now, he has surrounded himself with a bunch of yes men, and yes, they're all men. Unlike sort of the first year or two, he had people who pushed back, and he fired many of them, and they pushed back from various different angles. This dangerous moment where Trump's not consulting with Congress and he has a team that essentially will just say yes to anything that he wants is a dangerous moment for our democracy. Second point on theocracy here at home, it's a bit outside of the remit of our discussion on Iran, but it's something we've looked at where President Trump just Friday night was at a rally with evangelicals in Florida. And one thing that he's done really well, I think better than other presidents, is he's actually pandered and catered to key constituencies in the conservative base. And if you look at his attorney general, for instance, and some of the things that he's said, they've appealed to what I think is a very right-wing, and not traditional conservative, but very right-wing, religious Christian nationalist ideology. And the second thing that Trump does very well is he actually has a narrative, which many of his critics and opponents don't. I don't agree with his narrative, but his narrative goes something like this. Foreigners have been taking advantage of America. I'm going to keep bad ones out, and I'm going to make others pay more. Through trade deals and things like this that are better for America. Things like Iran and the Middle East, which are terribly complicated, I don't think for a moment President Trump spends a lot of time thinking through all of the contingencies and what next, in part because he doesn't care. And what he's done, as we heard from one of the previous callers, is he wraps this up in a slogan, America First, that is appealing to some. It connects with their identity and I think how they feel about themselves in America. My point would be is it actually is a fiction in many ways, as many narratives are, and it's disconnected to any clear sense of what America is doing in the world. And then the most important question is, are we protecting America's interests and American citizens? And that's where I think Barbara and I are trying to highlight. We are really on a shaky, risky ground right now, where there's so much that Iran and others in the region can do that hurt us. And we actually may be in a much weaker position. I think we are already, but even worse off because of this strike.
Let's hear from John, listening in Bloomington. Hi, John. So you've heard the discussion develop. Curious what you're thinking about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, first I want to start by saying that this isn't about being pro or negative Trump. Mm-hmm. That really, the question goes to, you know, NPR. And what I feel is this has been a real slanted and unfair report of the events that took place. I mean, you guys have done a great job of pointing out all the negative that this has caused or could potentially cause. But, you know, you're supposed to be a fair and neutral reporting news service. I'm just curious, are you intending to talk about, you know, the other side of this, the other perspective? For example, CCO just did a report in which they talked with Iranians that are currently U.S. citizens who lived under this guy, you know, when he was a general, and the atrocities he committed, you know, at home and afar, and how, you know, this guy is a bad man. And
you're talking about the military leader, John, who was killed.
About
Soleimani.
Exactly. And, you know, in all fairness, and you know, you've done a great job presenting one side today, and your guests have done a fantastic job at presenting that one side. But I'm just wondering if, you know, you're going to take the time to present the opposite.
Barbara, I don't hear this as it's one side, it's the other side. I hope we're having a more nuanced foreign policy discussion, but I can't ignore what John said about who this Soleimani was. And I've noted that there have been plenty of foreign policy experts from all political spectrums who have stood up to say the world is not worse for the loss of this guy.
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. I appreciate what your caller had to say, and I very much appreciate the feelings of Iranians who hate the Islamic Republic and what it has done to Iran over the last 40 years. But, you know, we have to face the fact that, you know, I guess if you could try to put yourself in Iranian shoes right now, you know, if a foreign country assassinated Mike Pence or Mike Pompeo, for example, on foreign soil, even those who don't like this administration would be furious. If General Petraeus, someone like that, was assassinated on foreign soil, and while we may see these people as heroes, you know, for many people, the U.S. intervention in Iraq, for example, it resulted in the death of over 100,000 Iraqis, the destabilization of the country, 4 million displaced, instability that continues till this day. So from the Iranian perspective, Soleimani was serving primarily overseas, where one of his main goals was fighting against ISIS and preventing ISIS attacks on Iranian soil. So even those who don't like the regime feel that the way in which he was killed was an outrage and a blow to their country. Whatever we may think of him, we have to consider what the consequences are going to be, and I think that's the purpose of this analysis. And if the consequences are ultimately not good, then for the United States, then we have to ask ourselves whether this act of what appears like revenge was worth it.
From Kojo on Twitter, the whole premise of this show is absurd. It's like you're trying to cover for this president. Leaf says on foreign policy, he has no principles. His only concern is appearance. He doesn't understand policy. Our conversation continues here on the other side of news with Brian Katulis from the Center for American Progress and Barbara Slavin from the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And your thoughts on this question, whether you have a clear sense of the doctrine or the specific goals that determine how President Trump is making these decisions. We're going to widen our lens a little bit on the other side of news. We're going to talk about what the Center for American Progress heard from American voters about understanding the overall decision-making on foreign policy. So pulling away a bit from what happened on Thursday night and looking at President Trump's foreign policy overall. And I'd like your thoughts on that as well. When you look at the totality of it in the 3 years that the president has been in office, do you see a driving motivator for some of these decisions? Think a little more deeply about it. I feel like if we pull off a little bit from just Thursday, the controversy of Thursday's decision, we may get some more open thinking about this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieMPR, to Phil Picardi now with the latest. Hi, Phil. Back to our conversation this hour about the through line of President Trump's foreign policy with Brian Katulis from the Center for American Progress and Barbara Slavin from the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. I want to go right to the phones here, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a bit about what other American voters have been saying to this, to the center, to Mohammed in Minneapolis. Mohammed, I really appreciate you waiting. Thanks much.
Thank you for answering my call. There is 2 points I'd like to make. Could you hear me?
I can.
Okay, perfect. So there's two points I'd like to make. The first point being, for the last 3 months, there were a lot of protests in Iraq. And for a very long time, there was not any movement that have united both the Shia and the Sunni. Mm-hmm. And these protests were mainly against things that were going wrong in the country, whether they were like a management of a lot of resources.
Okay.
But it also united the Iraqis against the Iranian influence in Iraqi politics.
Mm-hmm.
So what it did, what this move from United States, I think it was not well calculated, because that also now united all the Shias. And the other thing is, when they were, there was a vote yesterday, the Iraqi parliament, the Sunnis and the Turks, the Kurdish, they stay away from the vote. So that kind of also isolated those two minorities in the country and united the Shia all in favor of Iran politics in the country, their influence.
This
made them stronger.
Mohammed, if I might, this is good context. I think I hear you saying there were protests about the influence of Iran in Iraqi government. But now, with this strike, it has united people that were focused on Iran now against the United States. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. And the second
yeah.
thing
I was... Well, if I might, Mohammed, that's a really good point, and I don't want to miss it. I'm going to take this to Brian and Barbara. Brian, your thoughts first, and then to Barbara.
It's such an important point, Mohammed, and I'm glad you made it. I have a book that's just out that I co-edited called The Seven Pillars, and it's more of an academic look at what's going on in the Middle East and the drivers of instability. And what you discussed about these protests, you in essence, in Iraq and in many neighboring countries, you have a generational transition that's happening, and young people are just sick and tired of the old leadership, of the corruption, of the ineffective governance. And that was the focus just a few short weeks ago. Inside of Iraq, people were trying to change their government to have something new. Now, unfortunately, the focus, as you've noted, is on this and the worry, the very deep worry that many ordinary Iraqis have, that their country is about to become a battlefield between the United States and Iran, which is absolutely the last thing that most ordinary Iraqis want. So the main point in this, and I'm glad Mohammed raised this, is that the structural factors of instability are those sorts of things that we've heard about before in UN Human Development reports done nearly 15, 17 years ago, that they're internal to a lot of these countries and problems, and we can't fix them. But we certainly shouldn't be adding fuel to the fire with bad foreign policy, which I think is what is happening under President Trump.
Barbara, your insight on this.
Yeah, it is really terrible. I mean, you should remember there were demonstrations in Iran, thousands of
That's
people
right.
demonstrating
yeah.
against their own government
right.
After the government raised fuel prices very abruptly. And now, unfortunately, the whole narrative has changed. It's all about what the United States has done instead of about the failings of the governments in that part of the world. I think another aspect that's very worrisome is that we have roused this Shia sentiment against the United States. You know, we've been fighting a war on terror primarily against Al-Qaeda, against ISIS, against Sunni fundamentalist organizations. And now by killing Soleimani, who was very identified with Shia resistance to ISIS and so on, we have aroused intense hatred. And you know, by Hezbollah in Lebanon, which may be the organization that will exact revenge on the United States. It's done it before. And also these militias which exist in Iraq. And even Houthi rebels in Yemen, you know, they've all been roused by this sort of call for revenge against the United States. It was an extremely risky action by the Trump administration.
John called from Iowa to say, I think that this general seemed very dangerous. I'm glad we went after him, although I wish we could have captured him alive and not on Iraqi soil. I think it's important to try to rein in people who have caused so much terror. Susu in Minneapolis called to say, I think this was a campaign maneuver. It's a smart thing to get people feeling patriotic or instill nationalistic feelings during times of war. I think he was thinking about gaining that support domestically more than international policy. Brian, I want to come back to the surveying and the polling that you did, these focus groups that you did. As I read your results, and again, we should say that this was done through 2019, right?
Yes. Okay. And, yeah. And it was not only focus groups, but a series of polls to try to listen to what Americans were thinking.
Well, as I read the results, it appears that you get a pretty mixed answer when you ask American voters whether these U.S. foreign policy goals are transparent and whether there is any commonality in them. Is that right to say?
That's correct. And I think there's a broader misunderstanding of what America is trying to do in the world. People just don't understand what we're doing. And I would say that this seems to be a pre-existing condition before Trump. So this is not, in my analysis, just a reflection of where President Trump has taken the country. There are just many Americans, millions of Americans, who don't understand what it is we're doing in the world, and they're not hearing a clear plan. And a lot of people are interested and want America to stay engaged in the world as a positive force. But unfortunately, one of the overriding results that we got from our research is that, like everything else here in America, so many things have become so hyper-partisan and politicized. And you know, my take on this, on difficult challenges like Iran, is that these partisan divisions, and when we have debates that are just so much more about our elections as opposed to dealing with challenges in the world, our adversaries and our competitors actually take advantage of that and exploit that. And that disunity actually is a disadvantage in the world. I'm not saying that we should have some sort of false consensus, but what I'm saying is I hope we can have more of a civil discussion about what our priorities are, because Americans are hungry for that when it comes to developing a much more bipartisan approach to the world.
Except, Barbara, I mean, it is, our history is one studded with times of great disunity about foreign policy, right? This is perhaps,
yes,
not unusual.
Yes, of course. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War, which completely split the country. I don't think that these moves by the Trump administration are going to help him, frankly, politically. Many members of his own base are opposed to sending more troops. We've sent another 15,000 troops to the Middle East on Donald Trump's watch, and that's the opposite of what he promised during the campaign. The thing I tell people who support Trump is, please explain to me, what is the strategy? What are the goals we're trying to achieve? You know, from the Iranian perspective, it looks increasingly like Trump wants to overthrow their government.
Although he does, he has said repeatedly he's
goal?
Not interested in regime change.
But you know, killing Soleimani and putting and trying to prevent Iran from exporting any oil, threatening to attack Iran's cultural heritage, which he's done now twice over the weekend. How are people supposed to interpret those kinds of threats? And while he might not be in favor of regime change, I think Mike Pompeo is, and certainly John Bolton, who was his national security advisor, is in favor of that. So people should be very, very careful. This would be a horrendous war, far worse than what we saw in Iraq, and would mire the United States in the Middle East, you know, for another generation.
Call here from Kent in Spicer, Minnesota. Kent, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me. And a little bit of background. I consider myself a moderate Republican, mm-hmm. but I would like to say that I've been vocally opposed to almost all of President Trump's policies and actions since he's taken office.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I am also a veteran, and, you know, I'm 51 years old. I can recall most of the incidents that have involved Iranian state-sponsored terrorism directed against the United States
mm-hmm.
going back four decades. And I don't think that we can lose sight of that fact. And we've, during that 40 years, had a relatively hands-off approach to dealing with what I would call the Iranian problem. Now, President Trump, through this action, has targeted an individual that was a key figure in much of this anti-American terrorism over the past multiple decades. And I, for one, support this action and would ask the question, if not now, when would we better take a solid stance against Iran and its policies of state-sponsored terrorism towards the United States?
I'm going to put that question, Kent, to Barbara. Sounds like you want to get in on that.
Yeah, let me reply, because I think there's some important distinctions that have to be made here. You talk about Iran-supported terrorism, but the attacks by Iran have been primarily on U.S. military. And my understanding of the definition of terrorism is that it's conducted against ordinary people, innocent civilians, not people who are in war zones. So I would ask the caller what Iran-backed terrorism he's referring to that involves ordinary American citizens.
Kent? Barbara, I think Kent's still there, so let me give him a chance to answer.
Well, I am here, and I guess we can play semantics with the definition of terrorism all we want. If you wish to side with the opinion that Iran has primarily targeted U.S. military interests and personnel around the world, that is essentially what was done here. The general was a military man. Now,
yes.
It can be also stated that he has significant political standing in Iran, and I don't disagree with that. But he was a top military general associated with the design and conduct of many of these operations against our people.
Okay, Barbara.
Yes, absolutely. That is the case, with two important exceptions. I think maybe many of your listeners are not aware of the fact that Soleimani came to take over the Quds Force in 1998. And one of the things that he did after 9/11 was instruct the Quds Force to work with a group called the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, which overthrew, with U.S. help, the Taliban government that had given sanctuary to al-Qaeda. There was a period there after 9/11 when the Quds Force was not the U.S.'s adversary. It was an indirect ally. That changed in Iraq, and that was when the United States went into Iraq. And you may recall John Bolton at the time saying that Iran should take a number, suggesting that Iran's government would be the next to fall.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush put Iran on the so-called axis of evil in his 2002 State of the Union address. So I would argue that it was U.S. actions as much as anything that turned the Quds Force and General Soleimani into an enemy of the United States. And yes, you can call him a legitimate military target, but the question remains, what are the consequences? Will this advance U.S. interests, or is this just, you know, a feel-good act of revenge against someone who had American blood on his hands? And if you're a statesman, you have to consider, I think, the consequences rather than the emotional impact of something.
Brian,
this was not a good choice.
Brian, world reaction has been somewhat cautious. And I noted that when you talk to American voters about how they feel about the way the United States is seen globally, I thought this was pretty interesting. You find widespread belief among Democrats and independents and even 30% of Republicans who think that respect for America is diminishing under President Trump's leadership. You know, we've heard some from people this morning that say, hey, focus on what's good for the United States. I was surprised there was so much agreement in your poll. How do you interpret what Americans are saying?
Look, Americans are clued in. We foreign policy experts often think that we hold sort of the magic keys, but most Americans follow what's going on in the world and understand that under President Trump, it doesn't seem like we have a clear plan, and that the fact that is that we have to work with other countries to get things done, to keep America safe, that you can't do this on your own. And there's just this sensible sort of pragmatic acceptance of that. What I would find interesting, and I wanted to note, I've spent the last couple of days talking extensively to a lot of officials and leaders and ambassadors from Israel to Jordan to most of the Gulf states, the Gulf Arab states, who are on the front lines in this threat. And privately, what they say to me is they have no confidence in President Trump's ability to actually have a plan. They worry that they fear that they're going to be targeted. And when they look at what the Trump administration decided to do on Syria with the Kurds and the Syrian Kurds, there's just a worry that America under President Trump will just take decisions that don't seem to be connected to any policy and will sell them out, too. So this is the practical issue of how the slogan of America First may sound appealing to some folks.
And but Brian, this is even coming from people in the region that we would think of as our allies?
Well, they're technically, I think, partners.
Okay.
We have very few allies in the region, and many of them are quite flawed. But these are countries that are quite vocal about their concerns about Iran. And we have this thing in Washington, D.C. especially, where it's a very partisan debate about the Gulf countries and Iran and things like this. But to me, the real serious question is, how does America use its leverage effectively to try to stabilize the region, to deal with the negative actions of both Iran, but also some of these partners as well?
Brian, really a pleasure to have you for the hour.
Great.
Thanks
thank
much for the insight. Brian Katulis with us. He's a senior fellow on the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress. Barbara, thank you. Thank you for the time and the insight.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. If you got in on the show in the middle of it, you want to hear what American voters are saying and our excellent experts this morning on foreign policy, you can find it in the podcast. Search NPR News with Kerry Miller wherever you listen and then subscribe.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Kerry Miller.